From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Karl Rove is as big as they come in the world of Republican political strategists. But this year, this campaign season, Republican politics are like nothing we've seen in a long time, maybe ever. Trump, Carson, the bosses back on their heels, and Karl Rove looking way back to the election of 1896 and William McKinley for inspiration. This hour on Point, Karl Rove on 1896 and 2016. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your question for Karl Rove? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Karl Rove joins us now from New York, founder of the American Crossroads Super PAC, former senior advisor and deputy chief of staff to President George W. Bush, led both of Bush's successful campaigns for the White House. His new book is The Triumph of William McKinley, Why the Election of 1896 Still Matters. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Karl Rove, welcome to On Point.
Tom, thanks for having me.
I read that William McKinley has been a hero, maybe even an obsession of yours for a long time. Why?
Well, actually, because I stumbled across him by accident, and what I saw sort of amazed me. Our view of McKinley through history is sort of a docile nothing who was the tool of a wealthy Cleveland ironmonger named Marcus Alonzo Hanna.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, he's one of the most unbelievably adept statesmen and leaders, both political and personal. He demonstrated exceptional bravery in the Civil War, three battlefield commissions for taking on suicide missions, and became a respected member of Congress, so respected that among his greatest admirers were his greatest foes, and then becomes the architect of a presidential election that fundamentally realigns American politics. The period before him is one of the two parties close at each other and in desperate straits, and the next 36 years after his election is a period of Republican dominance. And the more I examined the man, the more I was amazed at his abilities, his integrity, his character, and the more amazed I got about the election in which he participated, which is full of sex, violence, backstabbing, betrayal, ambition, courage, twists and turns you cannot believe, characters you cannot imagine, and really cool nicknames.
We'll look at some of those. Silver Dick out of Nebraska jumped out at me here.
No. Silver Dick from Missouri.
The
Democratic front runner for the presidency, Richard Park Bland of Missouri.
Yes.
Must have meant something different during that period.
Yeah, well, silver was a big deal, and gold, too, and the whole currency.
Exactly.
We'll look at that. And then, of course, Mark Hanna, Dollar Mark Hanna, he was often called. And you're William McKinley up against the youngest candidate in the history of the United States at that point for the presidency, William Jennings Bryan, 36 years old then, and sounding
youngest
a lot like Bernie
Sanders,
even to now,
yeah.
And sounding
yeah.
a lot like Bernie Sanders back in that day.
Well, he was a populist like Sanders is today, a more agrarian populist than is Sanders. But you're right. There are elements of 1896 present today. Now, I want to be clear. I didn't write the book on the 1896 election to have an influence on the discussion about the 2016 election. I wrote it as a durable, I hope a durable recounting of an election that doesn't get its attention, and yet political scientists have studied for years and believe it to be one of the great realignments. The Gilded Age politics is broken, and something happens in this election, and a new coalition emerges that dominates American politics for 36 years.
There are elements within the Republican Party then of challenge that do sound familiar now, though. I mean, as you point out, there were big issues around immigration. There were big issues around the economy and a changing economy, the country trying to respond to. When you look at the party at that time and how McKinley changed its orientation, what resonates most today, Karl Rove?
Well, there was not an issue about immigration. The country accepted immigration. It was the changing nature of immigration. We had significantly less share of that immigration was coming from Great Britain, from the England, Scotland, Wales, mm-hmm. Ireland, and Germany, and more was coming from Scandinavia and Eastern and Central Europe and Southern Europe and Portugal and Spain. And so the nature of it was changing. It was heavily more Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people who were unaligned with either political party. They had not been around during the Civil War. They were not socialized by that enormous event that caused people for decades afterwards to vote as they shot, as the phrase went. Mm-hmm. And so McKinley was smart enough to say, we've had five presidential elections leading up to 1896 in which no president gets 50% of the vote. No one.
We have two presidents. Five elections with no majority.
No majority. We have two presidents elected with a majority in the Electoral College and a minority in the popular vote. And one of those involves a five-month-long dispute about the Electoral College votes of Florida. We have another president who gets elected with an Electoral College majority and a popular majority, and his popular majority is 7,000. We have 20 years of divided government during that period of time and 2 years during which the Republicans run the White House, the House, and the Senate, and 2 years during which the Democrats run the House, the White House, and the Senate. And they engage in gridlock, congressional gridlock, that makes today look like kumbaya around the campfire. My personal favorite is the election of 1890, which the Republicans take control of the House. They're sworn in March of 1891. Mm-hmm. Back then, they were civilized. They didn't make them come to Washington during the summer. So they come back in the fall, and the Democrats announce they will not allow a single bill to be brought up for consideration in the House of Representatives. And they do so by a parliamentary trick. They don't answer the roll call. So after about several weeks of this, Thomas Brackett Reed of Maine, the Republican speaker, says, I've had enough of this. And he directs the clerk of the House to count as present Democrats who are present on the floor of the House. And one of them stands up and says, under God and the Constitution, you have no right to count me present. And Reed says the chair is merely stating a fact. Does the honorable gentleman from Kentucky deny that he's present on the floor of the House of Representatives? And a three-month-long battle ensues over whether or not he has the power or the right to do this. And one Democrat from Texas, Hattie Martin, stands up and says, "Will anybody?" This guy was 6'6" tall, one tough hombre. He fought through the Civil War with Hood's Brigade. He got his nickname when Robert E. Lee reviewed the troops and he stood up in his stirrups as Lee rode by, waved his hat and yelled, "Howdy." Well, Hattie Martin gets up and says, "If anyone orders me to remove this dictator," pointing at Reed, "from his position of authority, I will do so by force." And Reed rules him out of order, says the honorable gentleman from Texas is out of order. Martin is so irritated, he starts showing up every day at the beginning of the session, taking a seat in front of the speaker's podium, pulling out his big Bowie knife and sharpening it on his boot heel to menace Speaker Reed. Now, I don't remember Nancy Pelosi doing that when the Democrats lost control in 2010.
Thank heavens it hasn't come to that. Into this comes your guy, William McKinley. Is he the Trump or Carson of that time? Give us his background.
Well, he's an incredibly courageous individual, enlists as a private in the Civil War in 1861, 18 years old. He and his fellow members of the Poland, Ohio militia show up at Camp Jackson outside of Columbus, and they're told there are no 90-day enlistments available anymore.
Which they thought they were coming for.
They thought they were coming for 90 days. So they say you got to sign up for 3 years or the duration, whichever is longer. And almost to a man, the Poland militia enlists and becomes part of the 23rd Ohio. And he's a private. By the time we get to Antietam, the 23rd has been bloodied up fighting guerrilla outfits in Western Virginia. And on the morning of the bloodiest day of the Civil War, is ordered into battle at 2 a.m. Now, McKinley, mm-hmm. is a commissary sergeant, so he's in the rear. But the 23rd goes into battle, and by 2 p.m. in the afternoon has fought themselves across the stone bridge and are sheltered under a bluff, having taken terrible casualties. And McKinley has been watching this all from safety and is deeply concerned about his men, his comrades, having no food or water or drink. So he commandeers a wagon, loads it with beef, hardtack, and coffee. And despite being twice ordered to turn back, he disobeys the orders and whips the mules or horses and drives this wagon across a 500 or 600-yard killing field raked by Confederate musket and cannon fire. Part of his wagon is blown off by an exploding cannon shell, but he gets his way across the bridge to safety, and the men of the 23rd rise as one and cheer him. And he receives a battlefield commission as a second lieutenant.
That's pretty
bold. But this was his own decision. I mean, he made this decision. In 1864, he is ordered on a suicide mission. It's at Kernstown in the Shenandoah Valley, and General Crook's Army of the Kanawha is suddenly struck at the extreme left by Jubal Early, and the Union front begins to crumple. And his brigade commander orders Second Lieutenant William McKinley to ride across the battlefield, diagonally across the battlefield, to reach the 13th West Virginia, which is in an orchard and is unaware that they're about ready to be cut off and slaughtered. He has to ride to them and tell them to retreat before it's too late. And his tent mate, later General Russell Hastings, says, you know, it was a suicide mission, and we thought he was dead. And at one point, a shell goes off right near his horse, this galloping horse, and everybody thinks he's gone down. And Hastings writes, "Out of the cloud of smoke came in a small brown horse with its erect horseman. He makes it to the 13th West Virginia. They retire. He rides back behind the Union lines and walks into the brigade commander's tent, and his commander, Colonel Rutherford B. Hayes, himself a future president, mm-hmm. turns to William McKinley and says, I never expected to see you in this life again.
Boy, that's a different time. No chicken hawks there.
Would
we be better off if we had more presidents these days who had that kind of service under their belt?
Well, we would.
Not Civil War service, God forbid, but understanding from that intimacy.
Understanding. And it's amazing because, you know, he ended the war a major, and this is a man who later became congressman, governor, and president. And the title that he wanted to be called by more than any else during the rest of his life was the term major. And he said, I don't know about those others, but I know I earned that one. And he had a bond, as so many Civil War veterans had, with their fellow comrades. What's interesting about him is he also had this sense that the country had been united at Appomattox. And in the 1896 campaigns, one of the most powerful moments is October 9th, when 2,000 Confederate volunteers, Confederate veterans, come to Canton, Ohio to visit the Republican candidate for president. The first time a Republican candidate for president ever appeared with Confederate veterans.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Karl Rove about the U.S. presidential election of 1896 and the campaign right now for 2016. Then it was Republican William McKinley. Now, well, who knows? Karl Rove's new book is The Triumph of William McKinley, Why the Election of 1896 Still Matters. You can join us. Do you have the broadest idea of who William McKinley was, what he stood for, what he did, why he mattered? Can you hear the parallels between then and now? Immigration, inequality, a changing economy, populism in the air. And what's your question for Karl Rove on that campaign, on this year's, next year's campaign? Karl Rove joins us from New York, and Keenan's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Keenan, you're on with Karl Rove.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you see?
Well, my question was, I went to McKinley when I was in elementary school, so I did some research on the man, and he is a great man and was a good president. But the political atmosphere was a lot different. You can't take a Bowie knife to the floor.
We hope not.
You know, I know Karl Rove said that he, you know, was with the some Confederate, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
Now, as a person that is looking for someone to vote for because Barack Obama can't be elected again, how does that tie into me as an African American? When, you know, can you talk about those type of issues and the inequalities and the because I know McKinley had to deal with those. And, you know, the immigration facts and the political deadlock that has happened off of this last presidency, how are we going to be more united as a country? Because some of the things that I've seen just as an American citizen is that we're very divided. And I would like for us to reach greatness again, because I feel like we're only going half-mast as America because we're not together.
Keenan, I love it, and we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Karl Rove, maybe it's good to step back and really look at it, flesh out some of the parallels that you're drawing here to share with Keenan and others.
Well, let me divide the question in half. Let me talk first about William McKinley and the plight of African Americans in the post-Civil War era. McKinley was an ardent abolitionist. He believed deeply, almost from the beginning, that the war was not only the war to save the Union, but it was also the war to end slavery.
His home in Ohio was not far from the Underground Railroad path.
That's right. And his parents were ardent abolitionists. In fact, as a teenager, he once argued with a group of tannery workers about the evil of slavery and the necessity for its abolition. After the war, his first political act is to get involved in a gubernatorial campaign of his old commander, Rutherford B. Hayes. And he spent his time talking about Rutherford B. Hayes and a constitutional amendment guaranteeing black voting rights in Ohio, and was terribly disappointed when the citizens of his narrowly divided state turned down that amendment by a vote of 45 to 55. But he was a staunch advocate of black political rights in the South. In fact, in the mid-1880s, he becomes a major spokesman attacking Democratic efforts to undermine federal protections for Southern black voters, white and black. And he also – this is an interesting thing I stumbled across. In March of 1895, he did something extraordinary. He's campaigning in the South to lay the predicate for his presidential race, and he visits with black Republican political leaders in Thomasville, Georgia, who come from across the South to visit with him. One of them appears to have been Robert Smalls, the captain of the Planter. This is the black slave who steals a boat called the Planter in the middle of Charleston Harbor, sails it out under the Confederate batteries, and joins the Union fleet, and later became a Republican congressman and a colleague of McKinley's. But others involve Florida and Georgia political leaders. And that month in Jacksonville, Florida, he meets with a group of black Republicans and then the next day speaks at a black church in Savannah. And it is the first time that a presidential candidate, black or white, has ever met openly with black voters and asked for their support for the nomination. And as a result, he's got enormous support from African-American Republicans throughout the South who, while they don't get any electoral college votes, the Southern Republican parties have basically half of the delegates needed to nominate, and he carries them overwhelmingly, in part because of this longstanding belief in protecting voting rights and treating black Americans with the equality under the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, two documents he believed in deeply.
But at that time, wasn't that sort of the equivalent of Hillary Clinton meeting with black leaders today? I mean, that was part of the Republican base, the party of Lincoln versus Democrats who were the party of white supremacy at that time.
Yes, but you know, it was done at a distance and through allies. You know, this is the first
before
time.
Him. Mm-hmm.
Before him. It was always done at a distance, and there was sort of a reticence about it. But McKinley was a really good person. Thomas Brackett Reed once complained. He said, "My opponents in Congress go at me tooth and nail, but they always apologize to William when they're going to call him names." These are Democrats he's talking about. Mm. So Democrats who disliked what McKinley stood for admired the man. And one of the things that they admired about him was his voraciousness on behalf of the rights of all Americans. What I take from this if you want to take something for 2016, it is that the Republican candidate needs to have the confidence that McKinley had. And back then, you're right. African Americans were part of the Republican coalition. Black Americans voted overwhelmingly Republican until basically the 1930s and in some instances beyond that. But what McKinley did was he looked at the people who were swing voters, who were not part of the Republican coalition. In this instance, mostly Northern Catholic immigrant laborers, and fashioned a campaign that broadened the Republican coalition and did so in a way that created a durable majority for the next 36 years. And so the lesson is if you're a Republican today, African American voters, black voters are no longer part of the Republican coalition, but the Republican candidate for president had better do a better job among black and brown and Asian populations and communities of advocating the Republican message and the conservative agenda, or we're going to lose the election.
How do you do that when your front runner is talking about Mexicans as criminals and, you know, being very, very tough on immigrant populations, talking, it appeared briefly, about registering Muslims? How does this square with McKinley's embrace?
Well, you got to nominate, in my opinion, nominate somebody other than him. But it is a lesson to the Republicans. We got about 6 out of every 10 white voters who voted in 2012. That's pretty close to what George W. Bush got among them in 2004 and what Ronald Reagan got among them in 1984. But what we need to do better is we need to do better at getting votes among the black, brown, Asian communities and among younger voters. And it can be done. We have a governor in Florida who got reelected by getting 20% of the African-American vote. We have a governor in Ohio, Republican, who got reelected with a quarter of the African-American African-American vote. We have a new governor in Texas who got 50% of the Latino vote against somebody who sort of looks like Hillary Clinton. And so, you know, we can do this as long as we have confidence in our agenda and confidence in our beliefs and a willingness to go into the community, to every neighborhood and every part of the country, and say, this is what we stand for. And you can actually get evidence of this in looking at Mitt Romney's defeat. Nationwide, he gets 27% of the Latino vote, compared to the 44% that George W. Bush got in 2004.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But in the seven battleground states with exit polling, he gets 33. And in the battleground of battlegrounds, Romney gets 43. Now, what was different between Ohio and, say, California or New York? Mm-hmm. Well, in California and New York, and you're in the Latino community, all you heard about him was, well, he wants self-deportation. If you're in Ohio and you're running for president, you have to go to Ohio like you're running for governor. You know, you go to Lima twice. You know where Gallipolis is. You know, you keep some change of socks at the Holiday Inn in Cleveland because mm-hmm. you're there so often. And what they heard, what the Latino community in Ohio eventually heard, was this is a guy who'll do something about jobs and the economy.
Talk about the contest between William McKinley and William Jennings Bryan, the youngest candidate in American history for the presidency, a tremendous populist orator. People would come from miles around to hear him speak. There was a lot of inequality. We're getting back in the Gilded Age here, and he was just white hot on that front. What did they represent to the American public, each of them, in terms of what they were pushing for and against?
Well, they represent a different perspective on the economic issue. I want to read you a short passage from the closing moments of William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech mm-hmm. And see if you think there might be a familiar ring to this. There are two ideas of government. Republicans believe if you just legislate to make the well-to-do prosperous, then their prosperity will leak through on those below. Democrats believe if you legislate to make the masses prosperous, their prosperity will find its way up and through every class that rests upon it. Now, that was 1896, July of 1896. Have we heard those words?
Hello, Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Bernie Sanders. And what happened in this election was that in July, Bryan gets this nomination by a series of seven accidents over a period of several days. Any one of which, if they'd gone a different direction, would have resulted in him not being on the floor of the Senate of the Democratic Convention at just the right moment, at just the right with just the right message, and just the right amount of time to stampede the convention. He's literally not considered a candidate before he stands up to speak by anybody except himself and a few well-meaning friends. The Tom Ashbrook of his time, or the David Broder of his time, is a reporter named Francis E. Lepp, and he's literally sitting on the floor of the convention, and he's writing his column, his article for the New York Evening Post, and there's a telegraph boy waiting to take it to be sent off, and two guys are looking over his shoulder, two respected political observers, one Henry George, the single tax advocate from New York, and another one William Russell Young, a famous journalist. And Lepp writes, the silver men are Democrats are looking for a Moses. And Bryan is looming up as a candidate. If the moment is right and he gets them, he could be the nominee. And these two men look at what he's writing and look at him and say, you're insane. We don't even know who the guy is. He's not a candidate. We don't even know what he looks like. And Lepp points him out and says, he's the youngish man with a smooth face, high forehead, and pronounced jaw, sucking on a lemon. He's getting ready to give the Cross of Gold speech. But he gives his speech, stampedes the convention, and then the election gets fought out for the next several months. He spends the next couple of months advocating this populist message. The Republicans are trickled down. We'll guarantee you prosperity through the free coinage of silver that'll put more money in your pockets. And he's winning the election until 6 or 8 weeks later, McKinley decides, I got to contest this issue, and takes another couple of weeks to find the right words to contest it. And we have a battle about which is better, a conservative economic approach for the country or a populist economic approach. And at the end of the day, McKinley wins a decisive victory by swinging the labor vote, the laboring man's vote, over to his column, to the Republican column, by finding the right message to convince them that his policies are better for him.
You write about William McKinley as a real innovator in terms of campaigning. Money was not the least of that. Maybe it wasn't Dollar Mark Hanna who made it all happen, but, I mean, I'm looking here at numbers that say that, William Jennings Bryan spent about $600,000. McKinley had maybe $16 million, a huge sum in that time. You're very familiar with big money politics. You're still in big money politics. Did money make the difference? Was this all about corporate America, shoveling money to William McKinley because they saw, you know, William Jennings Bryan as pulling down their tent?
Well, your numbers are wrong. First of all, Bryan did not raise $600,000. He raised half of that, $300,000. And McKinley did not raise $15 or $16 million. His campaign was not run by Mark Hanna. He's the fundraiser. He's the friend of the candidate and the fundraiser. Mm-hmm. But the actual campaign manager is an unbelievably adept and well-organized 30-year-old who turns 31 just before the election. And one of his jobs is to meticulously report and account for every dollar that passes through the Republican campaign. And yeah, the Republicans raised more money. They raised $1,962,326 through their Chicago headquarters, and then another $1.6 million that went to the individual state parties. So they raised about $3.5 million. The Democrats, on the other hand, raised $300,000. Now, I will say money didn't matter in the South. Republicans were wiped out in the South by violence, fraud, and the use of the government. So the Democrats start with an overwhelming advantage in the Electoral College because they got the South solidly locked up. Now, you can't attach a dollar value to that. But did McKinley and Hanna raise $15 or $16 million? No, they didn't. They didn't raise they raised only a fraction of that. And money came slowly. By the end of August, by the end of August, they'd raised $115,000. Both of the parties had roughly the same amount of money. What began to get them more money was as the campaign began to hit the right message aimed at working people, and business people started to open up their wallets when they became convinced that McKinley finally understood the economic issues and was getting in the hearts and minds, winning the hearts and minds of working class people.
I mean, I'm reading here from Mark Hanna, somebody asking him if Bryan might win, and him shooting back here saying, "Do you think we'd let that damn lunatic get into the White House? You know you can hire half the people of the U.S. to shoot down the other half if necessary, and we've got the money to hire them." He said, "All questions in a democracy are questions of money," Mark Hanna speaking there.
I think that's apocryphal. I'm not aware of that. Mark Hanna said a lot of things, but that doesn't sound like Mark Hanna.
He sure knew how to swing money. There's no question about
well,
that.
It took him a time to raise the money. And look, I understand there are people want to find a reason why for Bryan lost. But let me tell you why he lost. He lost because, after giving this extraordinary speech saying, "I stand on that behalf of the little man," he proceeded to divide the country bitterly. He gets ready to leave to Lincoln, Nebraska, to go on his way to New York to accept the Democratic nomination. Now, remember, the battleground states in 1896 are Indiana, Ohio, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Now, we have other states that come into play, but those have been the traditional battleground states during the Gilded Age. And he's getting ready to leave New York on Friday, August 7th. And at the train station in Lincoln, he says he goes to the East in the heart of what seems to be the enemy's country. He calls the East the enemy's country. And he spends the rest of the campaign on his way there, he says he goes to Chicago, attacks the town's newspapers, says my opponents are the great trusts and combinations. He says he repeats in Pittsburgh that he's going to the enemy's country. Not a single private in the ranks will stand closer to the enemy's lines than in whose hand is the standard. And he spends the rest of the election dividing the country. If you don't agree with him, you're a tool of the money power. You're in thrall to Lombard Street, which is the British equivalent of Wall Street. He tolerates vicious anti-Semitic comments by populist orators talking about Shylocks and the Jewish money grubbers, and refuses to say anything about them until the very end of the campaign. But his entire campaign is based around it's us versus them. We are the 99%. They're the 1%. And McKinley is talking about unifying the country and about how we're all in this together. No East, no West, no North, no South, but a common country.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Karl Rove, a about the U.S. presidential election of 1896 and the campaign right now for 2016. Then it was Republican William McKinley. Now, who knows in this race? Carl Rowe's new book is The Triumph of William McKinley, Why the Election of 1896 Still Matters. And, Carl, we've got callers for you. Joanne in Pembroke Pines, Florida. Joanne, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My question and comment is, why would the super PACs, there's been recent talk in the news about the super PACs trying to derail Donald Trump. Let me just say, I am not a Trump supporter, but it seems to me that you're fighting against your own as a Republican, and Ms. Thoreau's as part of the super PAC that you are. Again, why would you want to derail the process, derail him? Why not let the electorate vote? This just seems to me to be old, dirty politics, and that's what we now do not like. This is why I think Donald Trump is up in the polls, and it just does not look good on the Republican side. Just let the process play out.
Joanne, we've got it. Carl Rove, what about it? Yes, everybody's read about super PAC money and mainstream old school Republican leaders not happy with Donald Trump going after him. Joanne says lay off. Let the people decide.
Well, first of all, those are part of the people. Everybody gets a chance to make their voice heard. I'm not a fan of going out and having the super PAC I'm involved with will not be involved in the Republican presidential primary. And I'm dubious of efforts to try and bring down or, quote, blow up Donald Trump. Look, the 25 or 28% of the electorate, Republican primary electorate that are for him are not going to be dissuaded by those kind of attacks. And I think the effort would be better spent on helping somebody at the right moment consolidate the, you know, the 70% or 75% of the Republican electorate that's impervious to Donald Trump. Remember, he's been the front runner since July and hasn't been able – he has a high floor, but he also has a low ceiling. And I think the efforts of people to – you know, would be better spent thinking at the right moment of letting the process go forward and then trying to consolidate around somebody who's not Trump. But look, as regards people's ability to participate in the process allows people to participate. And maybe sometimes those are people with deep pockets like labor unions or George Soros or Republican super PAC donors, and other times it's people with just a vote and an ability to go out and make a phone call or knock on a door. But everybody gets a chance to participate.
Why are you so invested in these large money politics? I mean, you go all the way back to the Tillman Act 1907, banned corporate contributions to campaigns. Lots of that came into McKinley's campaign. That stood until Citizens United in 2010. And of course, we know what's come since then. And you've got, you know, you've been involved in some of the biggest big money super PACs and dark money, 501c3s as well. Why that path, Carl?
Well, Tom, let me ask you something. Did you run a program? Were you on the radio in 2000?
I was not. I came on right after the attacks of 9/11.
Right. Okay. Well, in 2000, the NAACP Voter Project, a so-called dark money group, announced that they'd received $14 million from one donor, which they then proceeded to spend on a TV ad excoriating George W. Bush as a racist. And I don't remember an angry editorial in the New York Times about that. I don't remember people screaming and yelling on the left about the so-called dark money.
Hey,
I get it. I get it. Let me finish.
Mm-hmm.
Labor unions, they are corporations. They're 501c6s. They are corporations. And corporate treasuries, their corporate treasuries literally put hundreds of millions of dollars every 2 and 4 years into congressional midterms and presidential elections, and they have done so for 30 or 40 years, and nobody on the left was screaming and shouting about the corporate treasuries of unions being used in dark money, money taken forcibly from their members without their approval and spent out of their corporate treasuries. These weren't their political action committees.
You're not worried about the Citizens United era at all?
No, I'm not. No, I am not, because what Citizens United did was it leveled the playing field. It took the dark money that League of Conservation Voters and Sierra Club and the others were spending on the left and gave not corporations. Corporations don't give that much money to.
But now
to
it can be a single billionaire.
Let me finish, Tom. It's wealthy individuals, and they have a right to do it. Just like the New York Times has a right as a corporation to editorialize in favor of its candidates, people who have an interest in the electoral process have a right to take money out of their own pockets and put it in it.
We see that right. right, and we see it exercised very grandly, but I still wonder if it gives you no pause when we see the scale that it's come to, that it can be individuals?
It gave me pause for years and years and years. I mean, $14 million from one individual in 2000, that was real money. And nobody on the left bitched about it. They didn't even excoriate the ad that claimed that George Bush was a racial bigot, which is about the last thing in the world he was. So now that the right is now doing it, now everybody gets exercised
on the left.
It's not just the
right. It's both parties.
Now everybody gets exercised. When the right began to do it, now everybody on the left gets exercised about it. But they were silent when their allies did. I was on the receiving end of this in 2004 when George Soros raised $140 million from himself and three or four of his pals for a thing called Americans Coming Together and went after George Bush with so-called soft money. And that was before Citizens United, and nobody on the left. I don't remember the Boston Globe or the New York Times or the Washington Post excoriating George Soros for it. And now that Republicans and conservatives are doing it, I understand why people on the left get upset about it. But in order to be consistent, you had to be screaming about it back then when the left only was doing it.
I just don't accept your characterization as one part of the political spectrum concerned about the money in our politics today. I think it's much wider than that.
Well, I think I'll accept that, but I will say this, and I think you'll have to admit it. The left was silent about this when it was their act, when they were doing it with labor unions and when they were doing it with soft money groups like the League of Conservation Voters, for God's sake, has been doing this for 30 or 40 some odd years.
Carl, we've got
the left never said anything.
We've got more calls for you. Jim in Cleveland, Ohio. Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, Mr. Rumba, I really respect your intellect. I can see that you're a really bright guy, but I think you are carrying the baton for guys like Lee Atwater before you. And I think my problem is that I believe that you're using your intelligence to cloud muddy the waters. And you're getting people to focus on cyclical issues when the structural concerns in this country are really, really more of what we should be focusing on.
Like what, Jim? Like what?
Well, I mean, you know, he won't admit it, but growing income inequality, the effect of trade agreements on labor, the effect of free trade on jobs, environmental issues, which I understand, you know, that's anathema to the Republican Party, but even military defense department.
Jim, you're breaking up on us, and I'm sorry for it, but Carl, I'm sure you got the gist of that. You're a smart guy, Jim says, but why don't you take more seriously the deep structural issues here on income inequality, and environment, trade problems, and labor, employment?
I do take those issues seriously, and I'm glad he brought them up. What is the cause of growing income inequality? I think there are two causes. One is an education system that is run by an education oligopoly that fails too many of our children. When half of the students who enter the District of Columbia schools fail to graduate from high school, something is fundamentally wrong. And education is the tool that can help us alleviate some of the concerns about income inequality. The other one is structural. I believe that the big government policies of this current administration have resulted in more inequality.
Why?
I mean, because I think that it puts in place rules and regulations that the wealthy can cope with, but the little man can't. Think about this. Dodd-Frank, it's made big banks bigger and community banks more infrequent and rare. It has demolished hundreds of small community banks that were, if you wanted to start a business, these were your neighbors who knew you and who would back you. Do you know that as a result of Dodd-Frank, 9 million people have lost their access to free checking accounts? Now, that may not matter to you and I because we can afford the $5 a month, but the people who lost them are working class people whose only connection to our financial system was to be able to have a free checking account at their local bank. And because of the regulatory costs of that for the marginal user, those things have been wiped out. So I think part of the process of income inequality is and why some of the well-connected rich get richer is because government makes it easier for them to use our good name to enrich themselves. And the government uses its regulatory authority to make it more difficult for the little guy to get a fair shake.
Donald Trump has said he may want to bring in universal health care, which Republicans have objected to for a long time, and a bunch of Democrats, too. What kind of Republican do you see in Mr. Trump? He's clearly not from the traditional mold.
Look, I don't see him as a conservative, and any Republican who supports him and has used the term "rhino," Republican in a name only, has forfeited the moral ability to henceforth use the term. Look, this is a guy who even as a matter of a couple of weeks ago said that he favored the kind of health care system that's provided in Scotland, which is part of the British national health system, single-payer health care.
Mm-hmm.
This is a guy who supported the election of a Democratic Congress in 2006 and was excited and thrilled when Nancy Pelosi was made Speaker. For years, she had a picture of a headline of a newspaper with his note to her on it of how excited he was about her. In 2007, he said he was delighted with her performance, but his only complaint was she hadn't done enough to impeach George W. Bush as president. He has been a registered Democrat, registered Republican.
Why is he leading among Republicans polled today?
Because he's getting in the latest Fox poll 28% of Republicans because, first of all, there's a wide field and he's got a high floor and a low ceiling. And second of all, he expresses the angst and anger of blue-collar Republicans who are furious with what the president has done or doing to the country from their perspective. And they want somebody who will pick up a brick and throw it through the plate glass window. And he says the kind of outrageous things that they're thinking and hoping that a leader will do. And he feeds on that and appeals to that. And they don't care that a couple of months ago he said ISIS is Russia's problem. Let them handle them. And today he says we need to bomb the expletive out of them. They don't care the change. What they care is that he said it in a strong and defiant way and seems up to shake up the powers that be in the country and attacks the president in a powerful way.
What kind of wild GOP convention might you have here? You wrote a couple of weeks ago that you might not have a majority of delegates wrapped up even at the convention. You said that Trump, Carson, Rubio, Cruz, Bush, you see as five contenders who have the message, money, organization, poll numbers to play the long game. Could they still be fighting it out on the convention floor, very old-fashioned style?
Yeah, well, it could be the first convention since 1948 that goes to multi-ballots. But I'm not certain how big the fight will be or how big a chance that will be. But think about this. We will have 28 states that will vote March 12th or earlier. And under the party rules, those all have to be except for four states in February, they all have to be proportional. And out of all of those 28 states, only one is a winner-take-all. So all the rest of those states, those 28 states, mm-hmm. are going to vote delegates, and they're going to be divided proportionally among all the candidates. And that means that when we get to the Ides of March, which I think is a great day for this process to begin, and get to winner-take-all primaries, states like Ohio and Florida and New York and Pennsylvania that are going to be winner-take-all at the statewide level or at the congressional district level, you know, California and New Jersey, these states are going to have an inordinate influence on the outcome. But we could walk into the convention in Cleveland with delegates who are bound by state law or local party rule to vote for a candidate who is really no longer in the contest for at least the mm-hmm. first ballot or the second ballot or until they drop below a certain threshold on the floor or until they are formally released by that candidate. And we could be in a place where we go a ballot or two.
Trump has been tough on you. He tweeted, total moron about Karl Rove the other day.
Yeah.
You're clearly not a fan. If you're advising Rubio or Cruz, or Bush, or I don't know how you feel about Ben Carson, what would you tell them about taking him on?
I would say take him on respectfully when the moment is right, when he says something that is wrong, respectfully disagree. But remember, this is more about you than it is him. So you need to spend more of your time explaining who you are and what it is that you want to achieve and how and you need to focus on you more than you need to focus on him. If he says something outrageous on the podium and you disagree with it, start off by setting the record straight and telling people what you believe. But focus more on yourself rather than on him. He's going to be where he is. There's not going to be a takedown of him. When you attack him, what you're doing is you're aiming at helping consolidate the people who are not for Donald Trump, who represent, 70, 75% of the Republican electorate.
Dale in Franklin, Tennessee, you're on with Karl Rove.
Pure rationalization from Mr. Rove regarding Citizens United. Tom, I think you mentioned something like, well, what about the fact that a billionaire can contribute? And it comes down to a handful of people having way too much power. It's just that's talking about privilege. If Mr. Rove really wanted to level the playing field, then it seems to me that he would be more interested in having more people with a voice and having it so lopsided. And by the way, I think it's also hypocritical because when Sheryl Crow confronted Mr. Rove, and Mr. Rove, who just a few minutes ago said that, you know, we are the American people, they are the American people, they have a right to spend $1 billion or whatever they've got. It's all about their rights,
yep,
regardless of how it affects others. You know, he told Sheryl Crow, he goes, I work for the American people. And she basically said, well, I am the American people. So I just see a lot of shenanigans going on there.
Dale, I appreciate your call. Carl, people are still really uncomfortable about how the money's been concentrated here. And, of course, you're not.
Well, I understand why NPR listeners, they tend to be.
I don't think it's just NPR listeners. I just don't think that's an accurate characterization of where the concern lies. It's right across the board.
Well, I disagree with that, and I appreciate Dale from wherever he was calling in. But look, the fact of the matter is that if you say to me, look, I don't believe that labor unions ought to be able to forcibly take money from their members and spend it on politics without their approval, their individual approval like a PAC has, I'd say I agree with you. But that's not what the law allows. If you said to me 20 years ago, I don't think the NAACP voter fund ought to be able to take $20 million or $14 million from one donor and spend it on an ad, I'd said, you know what, it upsets me too. But the law is what the law is, and I'm going to live within the system. And if Democrats do it, Republicans are going to do it. If liberals do it, conservatives are going to
do it. Are you going to get a new GOP orientation out of the 2016 election you saw it in 1896? Do you see it coming this time?
I think it depends upon the quality of the candidate that's nominated and whether or not they're willing to carry that message of conservative principles into new communities where Republicans don't normally show up, and if they fashion the kind of winning coalition that William McKinley did in the 1896 election.
Carl Rove's new book is The Triumph of William McKinley, Why the Election of 1896 Still Matters. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Carl Rove, thanks very much for being with us today.
You bet. Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.